Men, welcome back. Welcome to the Morningstar Men's Weekly Podcast. Today we begin our new study, Manly Men, and so we're looking at the first and second maxim, along with a little bit from the introduction. Stephen Mansfeld has provided sort of a roadmap for some of the things that he thinks are essential to what we'll call masculine manhood. They certainly are going to differ a little bit from what our culture at times perceives as masculine. And it's not as if culture gets it wrong all the time. I want to emphasize that. There are many elements that you'll see demonstrated in a good movie that are very much in keeping with character and code of what we'd call manhood, real manhood. It's just that, like in anything else, very often there are distortions. Things are not, let's say, 100% false as they're portrayed. They might even be 80 or 90% true. They're just not completely accurate. Or they emphasize one thing and yet not another. And so what I like to say is that many times culture is a caricature of what God would intend for something to be. It looks a little bit like the real thing, but not quite exactly the same. So you can sort of recognize it, but on the other hand, it really doesn't look like it ought to. And so I think that's a good way to lead into this first in the series on manly men. And as you listen along to the discussion that we have, keep that in mind, that very often the ideas that you and I carry through our lives about what it means to be men are at best caricatures of what God intends for a man to be. And sometimes the church does exactly the same thing. Honestly, the church has portrayed men in caricature fashion at times, emphasizing some things that were completely accurate and emphasizing other things that were not really at all accurate. So our source book will be the scriptures. Our secondary book will be Mansfeld's book entitled Manly Men. And we're going to look at both, and we're going to consider what is God's plan for masculine manhood. And incidentally, that's very important, because if we are image bearers of God, then wouldn't we want to make sure that we're being accurate image bearers? Just something for you to think about. Okay, I hope you enjoy this podcast. I hope it makes you think, reflect a little bit on your own life. And more than making you think, as you'll hear me challenge our guys during the study, I hope it calls into question something or things that you're doing and makes you want to say, I want to change this in my life. So guys, as always, I hope that you are blessed by what you hear here today. Share this podcast with somebody else if it's helped you. Perhaps it will help them as well. Thanks. Okay, so here's what I've decided. Yeah. The only way that this is going to have any impact on people is if you really make it personal. And I think there's a lot of times where we look at topics and we're great theorists. You know, we know how to discuss the topic. We understand all the little nuances of something. But I'm not sure that we significantly alter our lives or make improvements or adjustments in our lives as a result of some of the stuff that we take in. So my theory is this. Some of us have been in this particular study for, what, years already, right? I mean, like, you should all have a degree in whatever it is that we do here. So the question is, how is that making a difference? Honestly. And I don't need that. That's not our topic for the morning. But what I'd like to challenge us all to do right now as we start this is say, as the result of something I discover, I'm actually going to implement some change in my life. I'm not going to talk about change. I'm not going to think about change. I might do that. That's helpful. But I'm also going to make change. And just to put this to the test, and it's not as if that only happens here. Is there something that you've been saying to yourself, someday I'm going to? Someday I know I am going to? When did you start to say that? I think in the case of some of us, we were young and had full heads of hair that was the color it was born with, right? And now what? And we're still saying that. So I think that each of us needs to make a promise to ourselves right now as we're beginning this. Either
honestly commit to do something, or let yourselves off the hook and say, you know what, I'm just going to show up here and I'm going to do nothing with what I learned, but it's really amusing. And at least be that candid and real with yourself. So we're going to start with the introduction here. And there's only one phrase, one idea out of the introductory chapter that Mansfield makes that I'd like to focus on. He says that in a perfect world, every man would grow up in a tribe. That he'd have a group of men, a collection of men that would surround him. And he would learn what it meant to be a man and how to be manly in that tribe. So I'd like you to reflect on that honestly in your own life. And this is why I said this is some of this material is going to be very personal. Between the ages of 5 and 25, what did your tribe look like? Did you have one? As you look back on it now and you understand how you grew into masculinity, can you point to some influential groups of people or circumstances that helped to form your understanding about how to live and what it meant to be a man? I see at least one head nodding. All right, tell me a little bit about that.
Well, I guess for me, I played sports when I was younger, so I had my dad was very involved with coaching and what was around. He didn't have a job or he was away or anything like that, so he was always either in the house or involved with the sports. And we lived in a neighborhood, so a lot of my friends' dads were coaches or did events and stuff like that, so I would think that I had some positive role models outside of just my dad, coaches,
family,
friends, father, things like that.
Was that in Dallas?
It was just outside of Dallas, like in the Warminster, PA. Not 2,000 miles.
What do you think were some of the lessons that you learned, if you can remember? I mean, a lot of things that we learn, we just absorb. And we don't really know how we pick them up exactly, but we just kind of sense that we need to do things in a certain way. So, either through word or through example, even if it was never specified out loud, what did you pick up?
Just in general, that it wasn't always about me. Didn't matter what I did or didn't do, it was about being part of the team and helping others. Just my dad being around and then foregoing things that he would want to do as opposed to staying home and dad. So I think those kind of things. It might not have been evident back when I was little, but as you get older and have kids, you kind of see the sacrifices and things that they do.
All right. Anybody else want to volunteer? You talk a lot. Go ahead.
One thing, my dad was always around. He wasn't quite as involved with sports and stuff because we had a large family. But one thing he always said was, "We're going to do this as a family. We're going to, if we went somewhere, we always walked in as a family, church, friends' houses. He always made sure we stayed together and chipped in, and everyone did their part. And he obviously used the phrase like "make hands, make light work."
Mm-hmm.
Another thing that always stuck out to me is he said a lot of different things about my mom, very nice things, but he always made it seem like that was his main priority was to take care of her. He let us all know that in many ways. So.
Okay. Jim.
My tribe was, I grew up at Milton Hershey School. It's an orphanage for half orphans or orphan boys. And I went there with my brother. I was 7, he was 8. And we spent from second grade, which is when I went, until I graduated, 11 years. Spent 11 years there. And my tribe was the same kids who had the same circumstances as us. It was full of half-orphan boys who had, some of them had nothing. Some of them didn't have the family to go back to them when we had to go home for vacations. We were fortunate we did it. We still had a mom. But that group of guys, you lived with them. It was a boarding school. So they were all going through the same thing, they were going through. We all had the same trouble, and it was kind of like we not us against them, us against the people in authority, because it was very regimented, very disciplined, couldn't deal with anything. And that formulated a pretty strong bond.
Can you talk a little bit more about the us versus them? So this is interesting. I mean, we're getting into some different elements here.
We, most of us didn't have a farm, right?
Right.
And to have some direction, we had house parents, people who lived in a house, with a house of 16 kids, and a set of parents, husband and wife, and the other house parents. And they set down the rules, you know, how the day was supposed to go. You wake up and you had chores, and you went to school, and you came back from school, and you had more chores, and then you had time for sports, very little TV, and it was very regimented.
Okay.
And there was not only at the house where there were rules, but in school there were a ton of rules. And that's back in the day when you get smacked with the paddles, and they didn't cut you any slack. So whenever one of our buddies in our house was in trouble, and he was, you know, getting thrashed, we all rallied around him. And because he was getting thrashed, of course he was never wrong. He was, you know, he was okay. They were just picking on him, so we kind of bonded around because we're all each other had. You know what I mean? The people, house parents that were there, most of them weren't. It was a job. They weren't.
So you found more than education, you found community and support.
We found out how to take care of ourselves. And
okay. Scott.
I think a big portion of what shaped my life was when I was younger. I lived in a small community. There wasn't a whole lot of houses, a lot of families. And even though our families didn't socialize like a coffee clutch, we didn't get together, we did. We had our own independent chores from the household inside, because even though the families had different occupations, they all had the same values. So before we could go out and do anything after school or the weekend, we had to do our own chores, mow the lawn, take care of the chores, etc. And even if our chores were done, we were expected to help the neighbors with their chores. Then we could go out and have fun. And I think what that did was develop a tight-knit community that, even though they were my neighbors and my brothers, they were my neighbors, they were my step-parents, and we all looked out for each other and took care of each other and helped each other. And I think that really laid the foundation for me that has carried on to today, where I have those same mindsets of helping other people when they need them. And I think that really is, you know, kind of like our responsibility from God is that we serve other people. So I think that's really powerful.
All right. We've talked enough about that. Now I'd like you to think back, whether you've shared before, whether you want to, this is the first time. Looking back on this from the perspective of a mature man, what do you wish you had experienced? What do you wish you had gotten? What do you have to learn yourself the hard way, or what are you still struggling to learn that you wish someone would have taken the time to help you through?
I wish I would have learned what John learned, where the father uplifts the wife, and he takes the mother and he puts her in a light spotlight versus in the shadows of his own spotlight. Because I didn't have that growing up, where, you know, the woman, the mother, was elevated to a position of importance. And I still sometimes struggle to edify my own wife when she deserves it. And I know all the guys at some point or another, you know, it's the old, you know, jab, and they decided about the wife jokes, you know, for one reason or another. And I really feel that sometimes that can be detrimental. Even though we might think it's funny, they take it in a whole different way, and it's hurtful. And I sometimes am reminded by, you know, that wasn't so funny, or that wasn't so nice. And I wasn't meaning it to be in a negative way. I was, you know, trying to make the situation a little bit more humorous. And I still struggle today to find the boundaries of where it's appropriate and not.
So before we move on, so everyone think about what we've heard so far. There are things that we experience that we valued that we would like to pass on. There are things that we didn't experience, but maybe we observed later on, and we vow, I'm going to be better at this. This is so important for someone to learn that I'm going to double down on this when I have people that I have influence over. And then there's still this other collection of stuff that maybe we're each struggling with. Go ahead.
Yeah, I came from a family like a lot of us. My mom ultimately wound up leaving my dad when I was 13, 14. And me being the oldest, I had brothers and sisters. And I felt the responsibility too of trying to be the man, more or less, of the family and all. And it just kind of weighed heavily on me. And I just wish I'd had Dad had been around more. I mean, I did go fishing with him sometimes and that kind of stuff, but you know, he just wasn't there for the family I even found out later on, not until I was grown up, my mom shared with me that he was actually running the rabbits, the lady where he worked at. So, don't know how far that went.
Okay.
That affected my mom too, so.
Take a moment to draw some conclusions before we move on from what you've heard. Okay, so we talked about what is your experience growing up in tribe, whatever little or great amount of tribe you had. What would you, if you could, Scott, Utopia here, if you were to be able to craft the ideal situation, what you believe is the ideal situation, so that a young man is, let's say, 7 or 8 years old, what would be the ideal collection of circumstances that would help him to mature into, and this might be hard to answer because we haven't necessarily defined what it means to be a manly man yet, but what would be the ideal collection of circumstances that he would get to experience that would help him with that? Let me ask you this, is this a new question for you? Is this something that you've ever thought about a lot? Scott.
I think a lot of a person's DNA is their culture that they grow up. What's right, what's wrong, what's expected of them, how they're supposed to act within that whole little bubble. And I think one thing that I think men across many cultures could do a better job at is the ability to show their feelings. Men are supposed to be tough. They're not supposed to cry. They're supposed to, you know, just march on. And I think a lot of times that sends mixed messages within someone that they're not who they really are. And they live a life of a facade where they're someone they portray to be someone that other people expect them to be and not who they really are. And I think if we teach young children to be sensitive, show their feelings, show their emotions, have those emotions accepted, they would be the person that they really truly are throughout their life.
Let me throw an idea into the mix here for you. So think back to when you were a young parent, and I'm assuming that that was probably in your 20s. Right? For most of us, that's probably true. So in your 20s, you're a young parent, and you're starting to have influence over your, and we're talking about men here right now, you're certainly going to have influence over your daughters as well. But at that time in your own life, what are the struggles going on in your own life? In your 20s, when you start to parent children and start to have influence over the next generation, what's going on in your own life?
You're still developing into who you are.
And struggling with your own identity and not even sure about the wisdom that's been given to you. Kind of sensing that you're lacking some wisdom, but not even sure what that is. One of the beauties to tribe, and the reason I'm asking this question is I believe that church doesn't do it well, but could. One of the beauties of tribe is that you have, if you have multiple generations, Have you ever seen a guy in his 40s or 50s who comes to the point and he says, you know, half the stuff that I tried to live out, project to people when I was in my 20s, it was just crap and it really didn't matter?
Oh, yeah.
But wouldn't it be great for the guy in his 20s to hear that and understand that? And then wouldn't it be interesting for the younger fella, 10, 11, 12, to be involved in that same discussion? And so before we leave the idea of tribe, I mean, there's a list here. You learn how to be a man in tribe, if tribe functions well. In a tribe, a man finds others who are similar enough to him for him to relate to. Right, let's think about Jim's scenario there. Jim's tribe all shares a certain number of things in common. They all go home to the same place thinking the same thoughts. I'm not going home to my real home. I'm going home to this, well, we are home. So you kind of started to understand each other. So your tribe needs to share with you enough understanding about life so that they kind of get you. You can take time to be honest with them and they're not going to look at you weird. In a tribe, a man finds support when he's uncertain. Think back to your 20s, because I'm sure most of you now are pretty certain about life. I'm sure you have all of life figured out and you're pretty confident about the way it works. But think back to when you were in your 20s or your early 30s and you weren't necessarily sure. Incident, just to illustrate this, I listened to this great interview this past week, and I know I'm taking us a little bit off track, but it's okay. It was a good interview and it's worth telling the story. So the guy is interviewing this woman. She's done two attempts at Everest. The first was part of a mixed group, and she was simply one of the team members. The second time, she was the team leader of a group of American women only. Her first experience, they were within 1,000 feet of the summit. A storm moved in, closed them down. The team leader made the decision that they couldn't risk the lives of the people, because if you know anything about summiting those mountains, it's like when you get above a certain elevation and into a certain condition, you've got hours to do what you need to do and get out of that elevation or you'll die. So the team leader made the decision to close it down and go back down. So think about what it would feel like. It's a several month process preceded by several years of saving. Think about what it would feel like to have invested several years of your life and 3 months of intense labor, which it really is, to get to the summit of Everest and be 1,000 feet short. Right? That would really be disheartening, I think. 8 years later, somebody called her and said, "We're forming an all-female team to summit Everest. We'd like you to be the leader." And she said, "Why?" And she said, "Well, you've done this before, and I know you failed, but you seem to have all the right mix of things." Incidentally, she's done a number of other things that qualified her. I'm not going to get into that. They encountered the same experience all over again. Months of work to get to where they were, 1,000 feet from the top or less. Actually, it was probably less than that. Bad storm. And she said, "But this time, because I had been there before, and I had been in that storm situation before, and because I trusted myself more than I did the first time, as the team leader, I made the decision to press through it because I believed we could." So on her second time, she was successful. So I'd like to take that basic idea and transfer it back into the idea of tribe. What does a young man need in tribe that he will find no other way? He needs to hear stories of failure and stories of success that come on the other side of failure. Otherwise, he's doomed either never to reach his potential, because he'll quit and stop. Don't we know men who have done that? They were this close, but they stop and they never pursue it further. Or he'll be paralyzed and he'll never do anything. So I'm pretty confident that multi-generational male communities create the most favorable opportunity for us to raise up what we're calling this manly men. So,
Go ahead.
That's why discussion is so important. You talk about the tribes. You just think about exactly what that is from the beginning of time. Man lived that way, so to speak. They sat around the fire, and the men and the boy, young men and the boys, they talked, and they heard all this and heard all this. You think of Native Americans. They sat around, you know, and they talked, and they modeled, and they saw. And it's so important that that takes place, that dynamic. And I think you're so right, even the failing part. We've never done something. We're afraid. We're to fail. Like, that's going to be the worst of end-all, end-all. There's life on the other side of that. There is, you know.
It might not be easy for a while, but there is life on the other side of that.
It's okay. And you grow in that, and you learn in that. But you need to hear that from somebody. Because we look at some people, and we never have that interaction. Man, look at that guy, and all of this. And then you break down their story, and he failed how many times before he got there? He went through all this junk before he got to that place that we are so enamored with. You know? So it's so important that this conversation is vital.
Well, just to illustrate what he said, do you know anything about Milton Hershey?
Oh, yeah.
Failure after failure after failure before he's finally successful.
Yeah, even the little thing I just saw, they're called a Lancaster. It's the Cardinals, Hershey Cardinals.
Yeah.
That's what he failed with originally. Then he became a chocolatier. And now, 100 and some years later, now they're doing the Cardinals. Because they're a success in that, man. Right? Was that true? You failed with the
Cardinals? Yeah, I think so.
Yeah.
All right, a final thing that I don't want to leave here without touching on this idea, and it's the final thing that's written down before the first maxim. A tribe welcomes a man into its community and helps him transition from youth to manhood. How long does a man struggle with wondering if he really has what it takes, is a man? Have you ever experienced that? But yet in tribes where, as John said, where this is actually part of the culture, there's some really clear things that a young fella has to do. Some of them are very tough things. If you think of Native American things, I mean, some of the Southwest tribes of Indians, some of the coming into manhood rituals were extremely demanding. But by the time a young fella was groomed and worked through that process, he had a degree of confidence in himself that he could succeed. And then he could sit around the fire with his tribe and know that he was approved and accepted as an equal. Think about how many guys are in their 20s now and they're still struggling to find A, an identity, and B, a place at the table. They don't even know if they're accepted. They don't even know what it feels like to be accepted. And that's a pretty lonely place. So what I'd like us to do is when we take this home and start to really think about it, say, what can we as a body of believers, what can you as individual families do to foster a sense of intergenerational, multi-generational communication and grooming that helps younger men grow up confident?
I got a story that touches on that, actually. My son is 22, and just graduated from his apprenticeship. Followed my footsteps, and he was working with my company all last year, and he was doing well. He was learning. He just graduated his internship. That was 3 years, and it's a lot of on-site training. And then he decided that he wanted to come and work steady with us, so we took him to this next job, which is St. Christopher's Hospital in Philadelphia. And they gave an opportunity to him to connect the building, which means you're the one who's responsible for putting this piece next to this piece. You know, start from the ground up. And it's the top of the food chain as far as what we do for an industry. Connecting is, you know, the machoist, the manliest of men's positions. And he wanted to take a shot at it, and they gave him a shot. It's a big goal. It's daunting. And it's, like I said, it's only his second attempt at it. And after about a week, he called me up and he said, Dad, I'm going to have to do it. I said, what do you mean? He goes, I think I'm over my head. It's too much. I'm not ready for it. I said, you'll never be ready for it unless you stay in it. If you quit now, I said, you're never going to be able to push past this fear. I said, what is it that's crippling you? And he said, well, it's not fear. It's just I'm uncertain. I don't know everything yet. I don't know what I'm doing. I said, but are they pressuring you? Are they breaking your chops? Well, no, they're being supportive. They're yelling at me when I make mistakes and this and that. I said, this is the point right now where you have to make the decision whether you're going to fall back into the masses or are you going to persevere, push through the uncertainty and the fear, and come out the other side a better person for it. I said, go talk to your foreman, because I wasn't with him at the time, I was at a different job. So go talk to your foreman, tell him how you're feeling, tell him that you want to, you know, you're not sure, you want to step down, you know, take a breath and not do it anymore. And he went to talk to him, he said, nope, you're not quitting. Because that's another one of my tribes. We all have the same mindset. He'll never amount to a good iron worker unless he gets past his point. And his foreman knew it, and he would not let him back down. And I knew he was going to stay there. And that's why I told him to go talk to him. So he stayed, and this is the third week now, and we're up pretty good. We're on the fourth floor, and he's still tentative, he's still unsure, but he pushed past that summit. He got over the summit.
How old is he?
22.
Good for him.
Yeah. Good. And everybody I talked to said the same thing. Can't let him back down. Even Autumn, my wife. You can't. This is the point where, you know, she knew. Everybody knew except for him, because he was at a standstill with his feet up.
That is such a great story.
It's a good example.
This is Denley. If you ever lose your job, the motivational speech that you gave to him, you sound like you'd be a great football coach in the locker room. So you could probably, I don't know if you know anything about football, but you could at least make the motivational speech.
I told him, I think, very strong.
So Scott, when you were up to get coffee for yourself, was that coffee pretty good?
As soon as he's done his donut.
All right, let's move on to Manly Maxim number one. Manly men do manly things. All right, some of these sound a little cheesy at first. So before to be able to appreciate this, thanks John, to be able to appreciate this, I guess we have a couple of questions to ask. What are the questions you might want to pose of that maxim so that you could fully understand it? Manly men do manly things. Okay, what's a manly thing? That's certainly one good question you'd want to ask. What else?
Why can only manly men do it?
Okay, that's another good question.
Let me know it when you see it.
Well, here's a question. What exactly is a manly man? So if manly men do manly things, what do you have to be before you can do manly things?
Did you tell them we're all growing beards? You've got to start today with a real beard.
No, that's your group that meets on Sunday night. You must have had that confused with our group. Besides which, Dave has a head start. So it would be very unfair to the rest of us. All right, so what exactly is a manly man is the question. And we're going to say, how does God define masculinity? Because I want to keep bringing this back to some sort of a spiritual texture so that we appreciate what is God's intention for men. So the first thing we have to embrace, I think, is that men are a subset of humans. So before, well, at least in our minds we are. Maybe in the minds of women, maybe not. But we're going to assume, for the sake of this discussion, that men are part of the human race, with only one other gender. So what does God expect from humans altogether? If you had to have just a couple of simple mantras that you would live your life by, that in any circumstance you could look at them and say, okay, I could guide my life by this. I could make this tough decision based on these pieces of information or this basic idea. What would some of them be? So if you have a Bible, and I guess now that all of you have yellow books, you've probably abandoned the need for a Bible. Turn over to Micah 8. So Micah is one of those minor prophet guys that's tough to find. So maybe if you find Matthew in your Bible and start to go backwards, or if you have a table of contents, just go to the table of contents like Ron is doing and just turn there. Ron will beat everybody else there.
Sure, it's not six.
Huh?
Six. It's six, yeah.
Did I say eight? I'm sorry. Okay, so.
Will a real man help you? First of all, you need the right blood.
So, not enough time spent with your tribe in past generations?
Well, they kicked Jason out of the tribe.
Yeah, they did, didn't they?
They're back in next week.
Okay, so a lot of what you're going to read or look at next is somewhat rhetorical. So the first part is God saying, and we'll just read it. Hear what the Lord says. Arise and plead your case before the mountains and let the hills hear your voice. So God is looking at His people and He's saying there's some deficiencies here. We need to talk about these. Now, the very fact that God is willing to have this discussion with people through a prophet who comes in to communicate on behalf of God is very encouraging. It honestly is. Because here's the thing. When you get the letter from the bank that tells you that you're behind, when you get the letter from the credit card company that tells you behind, I know it looks like bad news, but it's actually good news. Because it isn't the certified letter that comes that says, forget it, we're tired of hoping to have a conversation with you. We've made a choice without you. Your input is no longer needed in this decision. As tough as things like this sound, they're actually good news because at moments like this, God is saying, this feels tough, this sounds tough, but I would still like to have a conversation because I haven't given up hope on you. Isn't that good news? Because the day God gives up hope on us is a very, well, not good day. Hear you mountains, the indictment of the Lord, and you enduring foundations of the earth, for the Lord has an indictment against His people, and He will contend with Israel. O my people, what have I done to you? How have I wearied you? Please answer me. For I brought you up out of the land of Egypt and redeemed you from the house of slavery, and I sent before you Moses. So I delivered you from an extremely bad situation. And I sent before you Moses, Aaron, and Miriam. O my people, remember what Balak, king of Moab, devised and what Balaam, the son of Beor, answered to him and what happened when Shittim of Gilgal, that you may know the righteous acts of the Lord. Okay, so we got some challenging names there. But all that aside, here's what God is saying. I've done a number of things that have made it possible for you to succeed. And any Jew that heard these words would have also been reminded of everything that happened. It was during the time of Moses when all the commands that would help a man to succeed, a family to succeed, a nation to succeed, were given. And so then we come to the next part, and this is the part that we need to consider. What does the Lord require is the way that my text puts as far as a heading there. With what shall I come before the Lord? Okay, so now we've moved from God talking to the people rhetorically thinking to themselves, okay, I failed God. I've not remained in relationship to Him. And this is God's charge. Have you found me so unsatisfying to serve that you don't want to have relationship with me? You'd rather go off on your own. You'd rather figure out how life works on your own. What does a 20-year-old man think? Does he really want community a lot of times? Or would he rather go out on his own and figure it out on his own? And the question is, why? What has he found so unsatisfying in community, in male community up to this point, that he says at one point, you know what, I don't want anything more to do with this, I need to figure this out on my own. And then we come to the point where the guy says, well, what shall I come before the Lord with and bow myself before the God on high? Shall I come before Him with burnt offerings, with calves a year old? Will the Lord be pleased with thousands of rams, with 10,000s of rivers of oil? Shall I give my firstborn for my transgression, the fruit of my body for the sin of my soul? You know, you can read by that quickly, or you can really think about that. Exactly what does God want from me in order to restore relationship? There's some pretty deep stuff there. Do you see what he says? Shall I give my firstborn for my transgressions, the fruit of my body for the sin of my soul? In other words, shall I actually sacrifice my kids? Will that make God happy? Now here's the really good news. He has told you, O man, what is good. And what does the Lord require of you? but to do justice and to love kindness and to walk humbly with your God. After you deciding that I wanted to use this verse, I just did a quick search on the word justice. And we're actually going to take some weeks and we're going to explore that topic in the in-between weeks when we're not doing this. It is astounding how many verses in the Scriptures use the word justice in them. And that's a real indictment on us, because you know what it says? It says that a lot of people in this world don't experience justice. That God is constantly having to remind people that He needs those who will champion justice and fight for the rights of those whose rights have been taken is a real indictment on the human race. And so when we say manly men do manly things, I think you could contain a lot of that right here in this. Manly men fight for what is just. They love kindness. Now, I know that doesn't sound particularly masculine, but if a man doesn't protect and fight for a culture where kindness can be practiced, who's going to do it? See, you don't need to tell women about kindness. Why? It seems to be kind of their nature most times. But if a man doesn't fight to protect an environment where kindness can exist, how can it ever exist? So it's the responsibility of the man to fight for, to build, and then to protect this culture that allows humanity to thrive. And finally, to walk humbly with your God. Well, what does that last phrase mean? What does that tell us? That this is what God expects as an ongoing practice for men. Seek justice, preserve kindness, walk humbly. What does that tell you? That for the rest of your life, there's going to be things that you do not have answers to. You are always going to need to rely on God. Would it be possible to walk humbly with God if God was not willing to graciously and mercifully provide us everything that we needed? If God were the kind of God that said, well, good luck to you, figure it out, could you walk humbly with God? You might be able to walk with God, maybe. You could walk angrily with God. You could walk bitterly with God. But you could not walk humbly with a God who was not willing to give you the help that you needed and the answers that you needed in your time of need. So the first thing that it means to be a manly man, I believe, if you wanted a short snippet, something that you could take with you all the time, and that's why some people actually use this as a life verse. He's told you, a man, what is good, and what does the Lord require of you but to do justice, to love kindness, and to walk humbly with your God. Let me ask you this in a different way. In the last 7 days, have you failed to practice those three things at least once? In the last 7 minutes, have you failed to practice those things at least once? See, it's not as complicated as we make it out to be. And what I'm convinced is that most of us get to the point where we just get so focused on our own lives that we ignore the opportunities to seek the justice of others, to foster environments where kindness could exist. We just don't do it. We just get blinders on like a horse at a racetrack. We got our own mission in life. And there could be people right next to us in need. And we don't do it. Now, we're going to talk about the tend your fields thing in just a couple of moments. And that's where we actually look at what's ours to care for. The next thing is that man is to be the masculine image bearer of God. That's another one of those really simple things to remember. Do you know what that means? It means that most people that have no relationship with God are going to in some way evaluate whether God is a God worthy of following based on how we carry ourselves. Now, we're not identical. That means that each of us as men carries with us the imprint of God in some unique way. Do you know what yours is? Do you know in what way you exemplify God and bring glory to God by the masculine life that you live? Or do you know what you would like to do to bring glory to God? Interestingly enough, now you don't know the rest of the book yet, maybe, but I can see how all of these maxims all come together, because maxim number four is manly men live to the glory of God. So I don't want to ruin the next time by talking about that now. Here's what Mansfield says. He says, to be a manly man is to be concerned with results and not only appearance. Scott and I were having a good conversation about that before we started here this morning. So there's a lot of things that guys do to prove that they're men that are of very little value. You're looking confused. Think about that and give me some examples. There are a lot of things that men do to either imply to others that they are men or prove to themselves that they are men, but which have next to no value. Come on, this is just not... Huh? Okay, that's one thing. If your view of man is that a man, a true man, is a success, then you'll tend to acquire a lot of stuff that makes you look successful. Does that make you useful? I believe that one of the definitions of a manly man is a man who is useful. Would you agree with me that if you were to seek justice for humanity, that if you were to create a culture where kindness could exist, and if you were to walk humbly with God so that you could discover how to do this, would you be a useful individual? Would you be a useful individual? Right? You would. Wouldn't you be valuable to other people? Of course you would. Wouldn't you be prized as a member of the community? And if you were to self-identify as an image bearer of God and a man of God, wouldn't that cause people to say, maybe there's something to this? So let's come back to the question. What are the things that men do to try to prove to themselves or to others that they are men, but which are not useful? They're just fluff.
Be the best you can in a particular sport.
Okay.
And it has been, I can use golf as an example. It becomes an idol for your... I've talked to you about this. It becomes an idol for yourself, a false idol. And it's just so self-elevating yourself, being the best that you can, because other guys are trying to strive at the same thing, and able for a little while to bring yourself to the top. It could be football or baseball or whatever, but it really has no true value to it. It's basically a false God.
I'd like to be a little player. You understand?
Any other examples? Okay, I'm going to step on a few toes here. All right? Not the first time. What I say next does not mean that I am opposed to what I am going to talk about. Okay? It just means that sometimes I question its value and the investment in it. Did you get all that? I'd like you to go back 50 years from today and ask this question. How many tattoo and piercing places do you think existed in Quakertown? Okay, I want you to understand what I'm saying. I'm not opposed to this. I'm not saying this is wrong or anything else. Do you know how much people invest in putting ink on their bodies today and steel in their noses and ears? What's that an expression of? Do you remember when men used to get a tattoo?
You were in the military.
Right before you went into battle a lot of times. Right before then, you would get something. Because you were going to do something useful. And you may not come back from that doing something useful. When guys start to try to be men by doing stuff like that is not useful, not as a commemoration to something, not as a simple reminder to themselves, but simply, if I do all this, if I put skulls and demons and this and that and sexy women all over my arms and legs and who knows where else, that's going to make others think, wow. If I have enough steel in my head that I couldn't go through a metal detector, that's going to make people say, wow. Is there anything wrong with earrings? No. Is there anything wrong with tattoos? No. But when it... Yeah.
Don't they think it makes other people say, wow? I never said, wow. I said, wow.
Can you do that again, Ron?
Yeah. Yeah.
People have different motivations, but...
Here's another one. Why is it that there are so few female rock bands and so many male or predominantly male rock bands? Ask yourself that question.
Because men are better.
I was going to say what you were just saying about the tattoo, saying that the men rock band is, in a nutshell, I think it's just all trying to call attention to ourselves.
When there it is. Beating your chest. When a guy has no productive outlet to express his masculinity, and he has nothing to do with that pent-up urge to be recognized as a man, he will do almost anything to be recognized as a man. The cool story that Jim just told about his son, that's a life struggle to become a man and to conquer your fears. See, that in the end deserves a tattoo. That deserves an I-beam. You bet it does.
Icon or something, you know, that means something.
Yes, it does.
And I understand that. I get that. I did this or I would do this. Now I get a tattoo. I can see that. And, you know, well, that's what tribes did. They had to accomplish something to get that.
Yes. So in the absence of a way for a man to do genuinely manly things, he will do stupid and unproductive things to prove his masculinity. Think about the number of young guys that you know, maybe some of you knew personally, who just drank too much and drove too fast. Right? Do you know somebody who drank too much and drove too fast? Once more than they should have?
This is what guys do. We're in college, it's part of time.
Also has a look at it as being a way that they feel they become part of the tribe.
Yeah.
By doing things like that, drawing attention to themselves so people recognize them.
That is such a good point. You see, if a guy doesn't have a real tribe that actually looks out for him, he'll settle for an artificial tribe made of other knuckleheads that are doing exactly the same thing. Maybe knuckleheads isn't a very charitable term, but it's the truth.
Well, on the same note, you can see it happen. It's okay. They really stop and look at it. One of the best inventions over years, but at the same time, one of the worst inventions over years is a cell phone. The cell phone allows you to communicate, but nobody communicates. Nobody picks it up and talks. So they're putting themselves basically away from everything, which makes them more of a learner than they were before they had.
So in our most connected world, we're the most disconnected.
Unconnected, that's right. So they're kind of out there, and they're always looking for some kind of a pat on the back from somebody or some recognition. And I think that's what drives them to do things, such as tattoos and things like that, so they can feel the part of it. They don't feel the part of it.
Okay, so you understand the difference. There are things that we do to commemorate accomplishments that we have already made that were significant accomplishments. That's good. When you become what I'll call a male poser, you're kind of like a male peacock, right? You just spread your feathers out like male peacocks do and look at me. Or as Ron said, can you do that chest beating thing again? There we go. Yeah, right. We didn't hear that, Ron. There you go. Sounds like a ripe melon, ready to be. All right. So I want to take us over to a story of a guy who did not do manly things. I don't think we have time for both of these stories. Well, as a matter of fact, you know what? Because it would take so long to read, I'm not going to take you to it. I'm just going to tell you the story. It's the story of David and Nabal and Abigail would be the primary actors in the story. So David and a group of his men are out in the wilderness. They're sort of in hiding from Saul. The last interaction that Saul and David had, David spares Saul's life. Saul says, "You're a more honorable man than I am. When you become king, please don't remove my whole family line." David says, "I promise I won't." But David is smart enough to know that based on Saul's history, that he can't completely trust him. And so what David decides is, "My men and I, we're going out into the wilderness. We're going to make it on our own." Until the time when God decides to deal with Saul, and that's why this story, I believe, is placed where it is. Until the time that God decides to deal with Saul, David says, "I am a man of honor. I am not going to do what God has asked me not to do. I am not going to take for myself kingship of this country. God has anointed me, and God will bring me into that position. So I am not going to be the one that takes advantage of a situation and kills the king." In the next story, which is the one we're moving into, David sends 10 of his guys, after they've been in the wilderness for a while, to a local, we'll call him a rancher. He's a wealthy rancher. I think the story says he has something like 3,000 head of sheep and maybe 1,000 of this or whatever. Anyway, the point is, he's got some, by that world standard, some bucks. And it's in the middle of what they call the shearing season, which means that it's the time of the year when he is taking in money. It's a joyful time. It's a time when everybody is in a good mood. According to the story, when you read the whole story, it suggests that David's men, among everything else, have been looking out for the guy and his sheep. When the shepherds were out in the fields, they provided protection. They didn't make a big show of it, but they were there, and they looked out for each other. In other words, they functioned well as a tribe. So David sends 10 of his men and says, "We would really love some supplies. We would, at this time of bounty in your life, we would like it if you could share with us some of the good things that you have." Now that would have been very customary. It would have been very acceptable. You have to understand that. It's not as if David sends 10 strong men and he's going to strong them, arm them into getting some stuff.
That was a standard practice.
Enter Nabal. Nabal is the rancher. The 10 men come and they approach Nabal, but undoubtedly Nabal is in the presence of his hirelings, the guys that are shearing the sheep. And so when the men make the presentation, they say, could you share? So we come in the name of David. We'd like you to give us some stuff. And Nabal goes off. Who is this David character? What does he mean to me? Why, there's all kinds of people living in rebellion these days. You never know who is going to come and want your money. And so he goes on this tirade, undoubtedly to make an impression of his masculinity to those who are working all around him. And we know that he does it in their presence because as soon as David's men leave with nothing, Nabal's men go to Abigail's wife and say, "You would not believe what your husband just said to these guys. And I don't think it's going to go well for us." As a matter of fact, we know enough about David and his men to know that if they decide to come back and do us harm, they're going to do us a lot of harm. These guys have cared for us. They've looked out for the flock. They've done everything right. They come and they make a decent request. And here is the way Nabal's men describe him. He is such a hard-hearted fool. Interestingly enough, none of this surprises Abigail. It's not as if Abigail says to the guys, "I never knew. I thought my husband was a nice guy." They don't say that. Instead, Abigail just puts a plan into place immediately. This is an example of a guy posing as a man. I'm going to... Ron, can you beat your chest again right now? There you go. That's Nabal in front of everybody else. "I am a man, hear me roar. And nobody is going to challenge my authority." Now, I want to come back to the simple thing that in Micah. What were those three things? Anybody remember? We just read them 10 minutes ago. Okay. Seek out justice for other people. Create an environment where kindness can exist. Walk humbly alongside of God, which means seeking God's guidance as you go about your journey. Nabal is a poser. We're going to take a look at one more poser. I've got to tell the story quickly. The name of the poser is Ahab. The name of the poser's functionary is Jezebel. So as the story goes, Ahab is king. Ahab has his eyes on a piece of real estate that is right next to the palace and he really would like it. But the piece of real estate is owned by just a simple farmer, a humble guy. And he goes to the man and he says, I'd like to buy your land. But the man says, no, this is my family land. I really need to keep it. I feel like this is a trust given to me by my family. I really, in good conscience, I don't think it's right that I sell it. It's not that I wouldn't sell it to you, king. I just don't think it's the right thing to do. Now Ahab, being a righteous man and a good man, not, goes back to his palace and acts like any good and righteous man would. It says he turns his face to the wall and he pouts. Until Jezebel, his wife, steps in and says, what's crawled up your butt? That's not quite the way it reads in the actual...
That's the message,
right? Yes. What in the world is wrong with you? And so Ahab tells her the story. Well, I want the land. It'd make a nice vegetable garden. I'd really like to grow my vegetables and not have to walk very far, and the land is right next to it. And the guy won't sell it to me. I mean, I don't know what to do. And Jezebel offers these words. Because here's a fact that you should write down. When you are a poser and not a real man, there are other people in your life who know that already. You're the last one to discover it. Nabal's friends and family already knew what kind of a guy he was. Ahab's friends and family, they know what kind of a guy he is. Here's what Jezebel says. Are you the king or not? What's the implication? What should a king do in Jezebel's mind? Not only that, come on, what should the king do? Exactly. You're the king. Just use your regal authority. Just go in there and take what doesn't belong to you because, after all, you're the king. But Jezebel is not a woman of words only. Jezebel, unfortunately, wears the pants in the family. So Jezebel is a very manly man. Jezebel gets the job done. She says, okay, fine, I'll take care of it. And so Jezebel constructs a scenario in a particularly devious female way of having... Is it Nahor? Is that the... I think so. Of having Nahor's field taken from him by accusing Nahor falsely of saying some things. So in the end, Ahab, who wants to be the poser king, who wants other people to look up to him as king, basically acts like a little child and pouts because he doesn't get his way. And when his wife... And don't you think Ahab knows what his wife is like? Right? Don't you think Ahab knows when Jezebel says, I'll take care of it, that nothing good is going to happen? And does Ahab walk justly with God at that moment and say, well, wait a minute. It isn't my field. There's probably other fields. I probably could get a field somewhere else to grow vegetables. And that was that man's right to choose not to sell it to me. But instead, Ahab, knowing full well that Jezebel is going to concoct something that's going to go badly for that fellow who owns the field, just turns a blind eye and lets her do it. So here's the thing. Do we want to be posers or do we want to be really manly men? I want to leave off with one final thought so we're just completely sure of the difference between a manly man and what I'll call a reckless man. There's a difference between acts of valor and acts of rashness. And there's a story that illustrates the difference also from the scriptures that I'd like to tell very quickly. It comes from the life of David. And David is now holed up in what is called a stronghold. the Philistines are out a little distance away. So if you can imagine, like, here's the town of Bethlehem, here's the Philistines, and here's David. Okay, Philistines are in the middle, between where David is and Bethlehem. And David makes an off-the-cuff remark one day while he's holed up in this cave. It's probably hot. They're probably short on supplies. And David says, boy, I'd give anything for a really refreshing drink of water from that well over in Bethlehem. It's just an innocent comment. As the story goes, three of David's men take it upon themselves to sneak through the Philistine lines, go all the way to the well in Bethlehem, draw water for David, bring it back again through the Philistine lines, and bring it back to David. And at this point, David is in shock. And it says, and think about what they have just risked to do this. They've risked their own lives. They're important men, so they have potentially risked the mission because without their help, maybe David's army does not succeed. And they've done it all just to get David some water. David recognizes while this is incredible bravery, it's also incredible rashness. And so what the story says is David, being an honorable man, he pours the water out before the Lord. And what that means is he honors the men's sacrifice but won't take advantage of it because he says, I could not imagine my men's blood being spilled for the sake of me having a drink of water. So what we want to do is see that in that story is contained the acts of a manly man and the acts of rash men. It isn't manly to be rash and reckless. Questions? You get that? Okay. Comments before we move on. Maxim number two. No questions? Okay, manly men tend their fields. So I don't have much time to talk about this. Here's the way Mansfield says it. He says that when a man tends his field and all of his fields well, almost nothing goes wrong. But when a man fails to tend his fields, almost everything and anything can go wrong. So because this is a metaphor, what are some of the fields that are in your life? And if you see from the list there on the back page, there's some fields that come to us by birth. So let's take a look at that. What are some of the fields that come to us by virtue of birth? Okay. Most of us here in this room are over 21, right? Is that a safe statement? How many of you feel a responsibility to care for yourself? Caring for yourself is a field that comes to you by birth. When you become a certain age, that field is yours to care for. We know men who don't care for that field, don't we?
Oh, yeah. It's obvious. You see it many times.
Okay. You can use, and I want you to take this idea with you and meditate on it throughout the week. The beauty of this material is that it is so easy to remember. Manly men tend their fields. Some fields come to us by birth. Many fields come to us by choice. What are some of the fields that come to us by choice? In other words, God gives us a good desire. He says, these things can be freely yours. Remember the garden? You may eat freely of anything. Isn't it interesting? God doesn't tell them what to eat. He doesn't tell them how much to eat. He just says, as much as you decide that you want of any of these things that you want, you are free to partake of them. Just don't eat that. Well, in a very similar way, there are many good things that God says to us based on your interest, based on your genetics, based on the way you were nurtured and raised. There are certain things that are probably going to be good and noble desires that you will have. As much of that as you want, so long as it's within my guidelines, you are free to partake of. What are some of the good fields that we choose in life? Okay, we'll assume that that starts with a wife. Okay, sometimes it doesn't, but we understand that. But so a wife is a good choice. Can you buy a field and not tend it well? What are some of the other choices about field purchase that we make?
Education.
An education. Any others? What you'll do for what you'll do for a living. Incidentally, we'll call that, do you have a job or do you have a career? Do you have something that you feel that you can pour your life into, or just have something that you can suck money out of? We've had that discussion at another time. I'm not going to, you can meditate on that yourself. So God gives us many fields to care for. There are some other fields that come to us by birth. But now as mature men, you're born into a certain country. You choose to be part of a church community. There are certain things that you either choose to be part of or you are born into, and do you owe anything to your country? Do you owe anything to the tending and caring of the things around you? And the answer is yes. Finally, remember Micah? Justice, kindness, humility. Finally, what God calls us who are committed to be Christ followers to is to look out around us and say, there are fields that have no tender. Do you know what I'm saying? There are things that need to be cared for that have no one to care for them now. Either the people that have been charged with caring for them have purchased the field but aren't caring for it at all, or they've purchased the field and they've left the state. Give me some examples.
I think a lot of men just get married and they have a wife and they figure it's alongside work and pay the bills.
Okay, so they're not tending to that. Now that's one field. I'm even going deeper than that. I'm assuming that once you understand how to care for your own field, there are fields that you look out there, and remember, we are called to be advocates for justice and to really do something about it, not talk about it. Do we know dads who have just abandoned their kids?
Yeah.
Do we know moms who are struggling to raise kids on their own? Do we see circumstances in our communities that need help and nobody's doing anything about it? And clearly the borough or the township doesn't have the funds to do it. And are there fields that we look out and we say, that is a field that I should tend to a little bit? So there are fields that come to us by birth, there are fields that come to us by choice, and there are fields that come to us, I'll say, by affiliation. And what I'd like us to think about this week is, are you caring for every field in your life well?
Just a thought that kind of ties into what you're talking about. When you look beyond your own situation out in the community, last night there was a knock at my door. I opened it up. There was a guy there with a girl who was probably about 5 years old. And he says, go ahead. She says, she starts reading for a paper. Hi, my name is Renee. I'm here to collect for the Quakertown Food Bank. And so here's a guy that is tending his field and teaching his daughter the importance of serving the community, of serving others, and doing the right thing beyond her own needs. And she had to be 4, 5, maybe 6 years old, no more. And so she was out there knocking doors, collecting for the Quakertown Food Bank. So they were going to come around today, and I knew it was for you. I said, how about I just get your stuff now? So I got a big bag and loaded it up with stuff, and I was barely dragging to the car. But, you know, there's somebody that was tending his field as a man.
That is a great story. And teaching his child, not only do we tend for our field, but when there are those in need outside of our immediate, that we will invest in that as well.
My son did the same thing with Cub Scouts. There's a lot of good principles that my boys learned from Cub Scouts. They do the same thing. They collect for the poor and needy. And like Vinny was saying, actually, he's starting to get involved with helping homeless people with clothes. But another thing, like perfect example of what you're talking about, is my wife and I got foster care because exactly that. So there's a huge need for, you know, kids that need parents. So that's why we're doing this. It's been a great experience.
Well, I was waiting for you to use that as an example because I know you do that, and that was one of the things that I was thinking of. Yeah.
So how long have you been doing that, Joe?
6 months.
Okay.
I've had 16 kids.
Really?
There's a lot of kids.
Okay, a couple of final thoughts. We have to wrap this up. It's written right here. A wise man knows that it's much harder to care for a field than to obtain one. Have you ever experienced that? Easy to buy a house, harder to take care of it. Easy to buy a property, harder to take care of it. It's easier to get into things than it is to take care of things. Now, when you're 20, you don't know that as much. You probably know it a little, but not as much. So, isn't this a great lesson for a younger generation to learn in tribe? See how this all fits together? We need to hear stories of, yeah, I overcommitted here. Now, those are safe, simple examples. Are there areas in your life where you have overcommitted? Are there fields of choice that you have gone after, and now you're so consumed with those fields, taking care of those fields, that you don't have time to take care of all of your fields? Right now, there's another truth contained in this maxim that isn't really expressed. You have to infer it. A wise man knows the value of each field that he obtains, and not all fields are of equal value. And if you neglect the care of your most important fields because you're too busy caring for the less important but maybe larger fields, you can blow your whole mission in life. This is very personal. So for each of us, we need to, at times, pause and reflect on our lives. Am I caring intensely for fields of lesser value while I let go fields of greater value and don't care for them properly? And then, yes?
I had another great example in my life. He was a high school teacher. And I was really good friends with two of his sons, and I knew his family really well. He was one of these guys who just kept taking on things. And they were all good things. He helped homeless. He helped neighborhood kids. He was principal of school, a teacher. He helped run the church. He was heavily involved with good things. But I remember at least three or four of his kids saying that they hated him at different times. And that always hit me really hard. How can you hate your parents? Your parents do everything for you. But he wasn't tending to that field. He recognized it at some point and backed off of some things. And now he has like a great relationship with all his kids. And overall, from just kind of from the outside, seeing that whole picture, how he made adjustments and now, you know, has a great house. You know, the family's always together and they're always happy and they do all love each other. They don't actually hate their dad. Was a really good example for me. But that was extremely valuable to watch.
That's a superb example because I think what I'd like us to hear out of this is there's fields that you got to sell. There's times in a man's life where he has to say, you know what, I bought too much acreage and I got to get rid of some of this. And it might, go ahead.
If we take too many kids to our house and my wife and I lose track of each other, we're not keeping up with each other, we'll eventually grow apart and we'll split something. We're very mindful.
Well, it's good you said it that way because for a moment I thought you were going to say, if we take on too many kids at our house and we lose track of them.
But that's very true. Even this is your family, your kids, your natural kids, and when that couple doesn't develop their relationship, the kids grow up, the kids are gone, and what do we have? We've got nothing here. And the thing is, you guys were first together, and you're going to be together after those kids. That's what's most important. And if you guys had that relationship, it'll be good for your kids. But priorities, establishing your priorities.
So a couple of final thoughts about this, and then we're done. Know your fields. Know the fields that come to you by birth, know the fields that come to you by choice, the ones that you have chosen, and know the fields that come to you by association. Take some time to inventory what fields are yours now and prioritize them. I use this example every once in a while. Andy Stanley, a while back, wrote a book called Choosing to Cheat, and what he says is that of all the responsibilities that a man has, there's some that he might have to shortcut at times. He might just have to not do as well as he knows that he could. And one of the challenges that a competitive and driven man has, do any of you ever feel competitive and driven? Is to do less than your best at something. This is going to come as a shock to maybe one or two of you. You can't do your best at everything. It's really hard to do a C-grade job at something that you know you could do an A-grade job at. But if you do an A-grade job at C-value fields and don't have enough time left to do an A-value job at A-level fields, in part you've failed your mission in life. So value your fields. And then finally, and this is true for some guys, some men actually have surplus capacity. You could tend for more field than you're tending to now. You're coasting. Maybe you've been through a season and it was difficult, and maybe you've taken a break and you've deserved a break, but maybe there are things right now, right around you that require a little bit of your influence to exert some justice, to cultivate some kindness. So, we're done, gentlemen. Any comments?